When is a war really over? Today on The World. I'm Carol Hills. The Bosnian War ended some two decades ago, but this genocide survivor says for him, it isn't over yet.
Actually, for a lot of people, the war is not over. A lot of people are physically uprooted. There's this, you know, pervasive feeling of spiritual uprootedness.
We'll hear his story. Also, how the fall of Zimbabwe's Robert Mugabe has led people in other African nations to question their longtime leaders.
It's becoming very difficult for leaders who've been in power to convince the people who can see the way things work around the rest of the world that this is a position that they deserve.
Plus, how East Germans fell in love with the music of Frank Zappa during the Cold War. Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. Thanks for being with us on this day after Thanksgiving. It's been a big week for news, some of it deeply discouraging. Just today, there was the horrific attack at a mosque in North Sinai. Egypt says more than 230 people were killed. But on the show today, we wanted to dig deeper into two other major stories from this week, the genocide verdict against Bosnian Serb commander Ratko Mladic, and also the end of the long reign of Robert Mugabe in Zimbabwe.
At last, freedom has come to our country.
Today, a new president was sworn in, only the second since Zimbabwe became independent. Comedian Mia Titi was overjoyed.
Like, for myself, I'm so overwhelmed to witness this event because I never, ever thought for once that I would see this, our former president, resign. It was like a dream.
At his swearing-in, the new president, Emmerson Mnangagwa, promised a new era of governance for a country that's been plagued by corruption.
Acts of corruption must stop. Where this occur, swift justice must be served. We have to aspire to be a clean nation. One son to high moral standards.
Zimbabweans are hoping for change after 37 years under one leader, though it's not clear how much change is really coming. After all, Mnangagwa was Robert Mugabe's right-hand man for decades. Still, it's a time for hope, and not just in Zimbabwe. Other African countries with long-serving leaders are getting ideas.
People in these countries are pointing to their own leaders and saying, well, you could be next.
That's Nancy Kachungira. She's news anchor of the BBC program Focus on Africa, and she's been monitoring reactions to the end of Mugabe across the continent.
One of the things I've seen a lot of, I guess it's a joke, but it's going around on WhatsApp phone groups, and it is made to simulate a situation where all the leaders of Cameroon, of Guinea, all these countries where they've stayed in power for more than 30 years are having a conversation, and then they say Robert Mugabe has exited the group. And apparently, Museveni is one of the people that they're thinking will exit the group soon. And so a lot of people are seeing that there are lessons in this for their own countries.
I mean, you mentioned Museveni. You're from Uganda. He's been president of Uganda for quite a long time. In Uganda, do you sense a feeling of, hey, maybe it's time for some change?
Uganda is quite different because Museveni does still hold some support. But one of the things that he tweeted on the day that Mugabe was asked to leave, it was a picture of a bunch of soldiers. And the caption said, now that the economic situation in Uganda is improving, we can pay soldiers better and teachers better and civil servants better. And people interpreted that in many ways, of course. You know what Twitter can be like. And a lot of Ugandans were saying, well, that's not going to work for you. You know, you can't start bribing soldiers now. Your day is coming. So there is a lot of agitation. And it's not necessarily a wave of change sweeping across the continent, but you could certainly say it's lapping up against the shores. There is more of a sense that this cannot really go on much longer. There are now three presidents in Africa who've been in power longer than 30 years, and that number is continuing to dwindle.
And who are they in which countries?
We've got Equatorial Guinea, the president of Equatorial Guinea. We've also got Cameroon and Museveni in Uganda. Those are the three remaining presidents who've been in power for more than 30 years.
So in Cameroon and Equatorial Guinea, are you noticing kind of opposition people or a sort of restiveness after Mugabe's been ushered out?
Certainly in Cameroon, there has, even before this, been a lot of agitation. There has been some tension between Anglophone Cameroon and Francophone Cameroon. And it is looking more untenable for President Biya to continue having his grip on power. And there is a real sense that it doesn't matter how it comes, change is definitely coming.
In the case of Equatorial Guinea, you've got Obiang. I mean, his family have basically ruled Equatorial Guinea for, I think, a half a century in some form or another. You know, it's a tiny country, but it does have oil. Is there a sense that this could foster some sort of real opposition to him?
Yes. And again, the thing is, these countries, we must remember the contexts are so varied and so different, which is why some of the people who look at Zimbabwe are saying, well, you know, could this turn out to be like Egypt, where things don't necessarily get better, or Libya? And so the context is really important to understand and to look at. And for Equatorial Guinea, they may not have as big a rumbling as Cameroon, but it does seem that countries always get to that point. It's just a matter of how they get there, which is proving to be quite different for Africa. But all in all, it seems to be becoming much more untenable for leaders to stay in power much longer.
What about the whole notion of the sort of strong man of Africa? Goes way back. A lot of it's been cloaked in, oh, this leader is part of our independence movement. Mm. Do you see that kind of archetype waning in contemporary Africa?
That narrative is certainly being dismantled, not least because of the power of young people. The demographics in most African countries skew very young. In Uganda, where I come from, 70% of people are under the age of 15, if you can believe that. And so there's so many young people who have much more access to the outside world, to social media. They're making their voices heard. It's becoming very difficult for leaders who've been in power to convince the people who can see the way things work around the rest of the world that this is a position that they deserve. Just this year, we saw an election annulled in Kenya, which is something that has never happened on the continent before. And so there is certainly a sense that people are waking up to what should rightfully be theirs, to what their rights are, to what kind of voice they should have. And ultimately, that's the thing that challenges the strong man idea, is having stable, strong institutions that can outlive, outlast, and outdeliver them.
So you see the sort of challenging of the results in Kenya as an important move forward.
It certainly is. The continent really looked at Kenya in this instance as perhaps a harbinger of things to come, a harbinger of change, that we could actually enter an era where the status quo can be challenged. And sometimes it's just about having the sense that it's possible, and that's all you need to move people into action.
We've been speaking with Nancy Kachungira. She's the news anchor for the BBC's Focus on Africa. Thanks a lot, Nancy.
Thank you for talking to me.
Now to the other big story we covered this week, the life sentence handed down to Ratko Mladic, the so-called Butcher of Bosnia. He was found guilty by a UN war crimes tribunal of genocide and other crimes against humanity. Mladic was a Bosnian Serb commander during the war in Bosnia in the 1990s, and it was under his leadership that Bosnian Serb forces carried out a genocide in the town of Srebrenica, murdering thousands of Bosnian Muslim men and boys who'd sought refuge there, supposedly under UN protection. Emir Suljevic witnessed that atrocity and wrote one of the key accounts of what happened. He later served as defense minister for Bosnia and as education minister for Sarajevo. Emir, first of all, what was your reaction when you heard the verdict?
I'm probably still going through, you know, whatever the personal feelings I'm having about this. I'm not really sure that I don't know how to say this, but I'm still, you know, whatever personal feelings I have for this thing, I'm still going through it. There is no definitive emotional sort of type of judgment out there as far as I'm concerned. This trial and this judgment is more important for other reasons, really. The bigger picture, and the bigger picture here is that Ratko Mladic was actually found guilty of genocide against a Muslim population living in Bosnia-Herzegovina that it was essentially done through the aid and help of the Republic of Serbia. It's Ratko Mladic that actually first, made us hear the echoes of Holocaust in Europe after World War II.
You mentioned that you're not done kind of with your feelings about the whole thing in general. What are you still wrestling with?
Here's the thing. I mean, surviving is not as easy as people think it is. So surviving was very hard for a lot of people. Actually, for a lot of people, the war is not over. A lot of people are physically uprooted. There's this, pervasive feeling of spiritual uprootedness. To get out of the very long shadow of this crime that was committed against us and this crime that was committed against you personally. So, it's getting from under this huge and long shadow.
And, of course, the crime is something you witnessed. You were 20 years old in the summer of 1995 in Srebrenica. You had fled to Srebrenica with your family because of attacks by Serbs where you lived. So by 1995, you'd been in Srebrenica for 3 years. What do you remember about what happened when Mladic's forces entered the town?
There's so much I remember that I don't want to remember, and there's so many things I would like to remember, but I have forgotten. What I remember about that is utter chaos. It's this is the feeling of complete and utter defenselessness, helplessness. When your life is in someone else's hands, I guess it kind of stays with you your whole life.
At the time, as I mentioned, you were 20 years old and you had taught yourself English and you were working for UN people in Srebrenica. I read that you actually, at that time, encountered Ratko Mladic. What was that interaction like?
Well, I don't know. I met him on July 12th. It was, how can I say it? I was sure I was not going to survive, and it's a very heavy feeling. It's you actually physically have physical difficulties moving. I did at least from point A to point B. It's like you have chains around your legs, and I had a very brief interaction with him, but there was no doubt in my mind that he was the absolute master of life and death there and then.
After the Balkan Wars and the episodes of ethnic cleansing, there was a lot of talk about never again. Has this conviction and what we now understand about what happened in the former Yugoslavia, do you think it's made future attempts at ethnic cleansing less likely?
I don't think so. I mean, we disregard how much these people learn from each other. The ethnic cleansing is a policy. It's like a healthcare policy, a labor policy, whatever. Governments sometimes, as we have seen in case of Assad, as we are now watching and seeing it in Myanmar, governments decide to institute this type of policy against its populations. What we're looking at in Burma, in Myanmar nowadays, is very much from the same page, a page from the same book that Milosevic, Karadzic, and Mladic and others employed in Bosnia. It's very simple. You see concentration of population. You see rape used as a weapon. I'm looking at Myanmar and I'm thinking, that the only difference between us in Bosnia in the 90s and them now is that we were lucky enough that United States of America was at the apex of its power and that it could actually act to the extent that it acted, sometimes even unilaterally, to prevent a total annihilation of a group of people living in Bosnia-Herzegovina. That's not the case now. And that's why we are seeing what we are seeing in Myanmar.
Emir Suljovic was a survivor of the genocide in Srebrenica during the war in Bosnia in the 1990s. Coming up, the Coast Guard's floating prisons and a vampire that battles climate change. It's On the World. The Coast Guard has taken on a new role as enforcer of the sea. And in that role, it's been apprehending and arresting suspected drug smugglers in international waters. Seth Fried Wessler wrote about the Coast Guard and how it's operating a sort of floating prison for the New York Times. Seth, the Coast Guard usually has a reputation of being the good guys out there, you know, rescuing people, apprehending bad guys. We've done stories about that. I take it it's a little bit more complicated.
It is. The Coast Guard has a broad mission. It does search and rescue work. It enforces fisheries laws. It enforces drug laws in the oceans. And what few people know is that the U.S. Coast Guard has actually been deployed in recent years deep into the Pacific Ocean to interdict drug smugglers moving between South America and Central America, thousands of miles from the nearest U.S. port, where they're detaining suspected smugglers and holding them aboard these Coast Guard cutters. And what I found in my reporting is that men who are moving cocaine in the Pacific Ocean are often held for weeks or even months shackled aboard these boats, often exposed to the elements.
One thing right off the bat is, what is the international law that allows the Coast Guard to go so far out into international waters and apprehend people?
Well, international waters sort of exist in this legal gray zone. And it's generally the case that any country can stop a boat on the high seas if that vessel is not registered in another country. And they can search that boat. If a boat is flagged to another country, the United States has entered into dozens of agreements, largely with Latin American countries, to be able to search boats registered in those countries. And it's U.S. law that permits the United States to then detain these suspected smugglers and bring them back to the United States to prosecute them criminally.
I want to go to your own story that you write about in the New York Times, which focuses on some Ecuadorians who are out there transporting drugs, and they end up shackled for many, many days on a Coast Guard boat. Give us the quick thumbnail sketch of this one guy in particular, Arsentales, and how he ended up there.
Yeah, well, he is a fisherman from a coastal town in Ecuador, was having a particularly economically rough year and made a decision to take a job smuggling cocaine. And that cocaine was bound for Central America. He really didn't know all that much. As he was moving this cocaine on a boat with three other men, they were approaching Central America, approaching Guatemala, and the U.S. Navy and Coast Guard interdicted that boat, pulled these men on board. And then for the next 70 days, Mr. Arsentales and the other men he was detained with were held, always chained by their ankle to the deck of a ship or to a cable running along one of these large Coast Guard or Navy ships, as these Coast Guard cutters went about their patrols.
So this guy, Arsentales, and another guy, they're on board a ship. This is a Coast Guard ship. And they're basically exposed to the elements and basically shackled and not getting much food. What is the law that allows that to happen?
The Coast Guard makes the argument that these people are not formally under arrest until they get to the United States, that they're simply being held while the Coast Guard deals with the logistical challenges of trying to get these men onto shore into an airplane and flown to Florida where they'll be prosecuted. And courts have generally bought the government's argument, the argument by the Coast Guard and by federal prosecutors, that these logistical delays are legitimate. It's hard enough to get people back.
Is part of the strategy that the Coast Guard and by extension the U.S. government think that by going after these small players that they're going to get to the big players?
Yeah, the federal government has said that these low-level smugglers, these guys who are really at the bottom of the smuggling hierarchy, can provide information to federal prosecutors, to the federal government, that will allow them to sort of dismantle larger criminal networks to go.
And does that happen?
Well, it's generally the case. A federal judge who sentenced Arsentales, the man in my story, said quite clearly, you know, this is pretty sad. This guy really can't offer much at all. And because he has very little to offer, he has very little to negotiate with, and so he's getting this 10-year sentence. You know, I think we think about the ocean often as a vast, empty place. But for these fishermen, the ocean is the geography of their life. And so when I talked to Arsentales, for example, he said to me, the ocean used to be a place that for me represented freedom. But now on this Coast Guard ship, it's like a prison in the open ocean.
Seth Fried Wessler is a New York-based investigative reporter. His story for the New York Times was reported in partnership with the Investigative Fund at the Nation Institute. Thanks a lot, Seth.
Thank you very much.
A change of tone here. We heard about a new comic book series that takes on the issue of climate change. Dark Fang, that's the title. It features an undersea vampire. She battles oil spills and multinational corporations that are degrading the planet. Dark Fang is getting good reviews from comic enthusiasts. The series even got a shout-out from the website Yale Climate Connections. So we downloaded the first edition, and it wasn't quite what we were expecting. It actually seems pretty sexist. So we called up the creators, writers Miles Gunter and illustrator Kelsey Shannon. Miles, you first. What's the idea behind Dark Fang?
Well, Dark Fang is the story of Vala, a vampire who realizes that climate change is eventually going to wipe out her food supply, which are human beings. So she sets out to take down the fossil fuel industry.
Now, Kelsey, this may be an unfair question, but my first impression when I looked at this was, what? It's like this sexy babe with huge breasts and sort of a lot of TNA kind of ideas there. So why did you decide to draw her that way? And how does this relate to the environment?
Well, I'm not sure that how she looks is related to the environment, but it certainly helps for readers that maybe aren't interested in this subject that are used to the typical comic book TNA fare, which is making a drastic change as we speak. But it was like a way to get into it. And plus, it was important to me to have fun drawing this. So that's why I did it in a cartoony style and bright colors, because we spend so much time and energy on these. It's still important to kind of enjoy what you're doing.
But I think somebody coming to this will simply say a woman with giant breasts seducing men and drinking their blood. I mean, how are you really trying to get the message across?
It's an entry point, and it's a little bit of a fake out. We kind of wanted to create this idea that it's going to be kind of this misogynistic story, but it's really not.
Miles, who is the audience for this?
Well, I think that the audience is really people that enjoy vampire stories and people that are, you know, angry and frustrated about what's going on right now.
But what age group?
I would say probably, you know, late teen on up. So anybody that could get into an R-rated movie, it's definitely a mature reader's title. It's not for small children.
Miles, do you think that the message, the kind of environment message, will come through? You know, when I was reading it, I didn't think, oh, this is dealing with the environment. I just thought, oh, there's this sexy, sexist kind of drawing of somebody. It's not what comes to mind.
Right. The first issue is very much setting up the character and her backstory and where she's coming from. And then with the second issue, it's propelling much more into the story of her versus oil companies and versus politicians and using her powers. And in a way, it really provides a catharsis, I think, for people that are just really frustrated about where things are right now with climate change in our country.
Writer Miles Gunter and illustrator Kelsey Shannon are the creators of a new comic series, Dark Fang. Thank you both for being with us.
Thanks.
Thanks for having us.
You can see some of Dark Fang issue number one at PRI.org. It's the world. I'm Carol Hills. Wolfhard Kutz grew up in communist East Germany, and when the Berlin Wall fell, he got to read his Stasi secret police file.
I read that I'm a criminal, and I influence the young people with the music of Frank Zappa.
Frank Zappa under communism. Ahead on the world. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with the world. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH in Boston. We have for you now the story of an extraordinary cultural exchange between an eccentric American rock star and the people of a communist country. I'm talking about Frank Zappa and his fans in East Germany. If that sounds kind of familiar, it's because we originally aired a version of that story back in August. But you didn't hear the full story. That is, unless you heard it on our language podcast, The World in Words. Radio listeners heard a shorter version until today, when we bring you the full story from The World in Words, Patrick Cox.
Wolfhard Kutz has lived two lives, before the Berlin Wall came down and after. While the wall was still in place, he was a citizen of the socialist utopia of East Germany, where he was spied on a lot. Soon after East Germany ceased to exist, Wolfhard was allowed to read his Stasi file.
I read that I have a tape recorder and a plattenspieler.
A turntable
and Play-Doh records.
The Stasi, of course, were East Germany's secret police. They enlisted ordinary people to report back about their neighbors, their friends, their family. Most people's files are absurdly mundane. You read a book, you go to a cafe, you listen to a musician. In Wolfhard's case, 21 people informed on him and his listening habits.
There also I read that I'm a criminal beeinflusste, decadente Jugendliche.
A criminal influenced, decadent young guy.
Young guy from the West propaganda, and I influence the young people with the music of Frank Zappa.
Influenced young people with the music of Frank Zappa. Now, that may seem laughable, ridiculous. Frank Zappa? An American rock musician who commissioned orchestras to play his music and who had a taste for smutty lyrics? But I think the Stasi were onto something. Even if they didn't understand Zappa, they understood that people who liked Zappa were trouble.
This is a song about vegetables. They keep you regular. They're real good for you.
I've been a big fan of Frank Zappa and his band, the Mothers of Invention, since I was about 20. I was living in Denmark back then, and my friends there introduced me to his music. Partly, I think, to have me explain some of Zappa's more obscure lyrics. There was no shortage of those. All the vegetables will respond to you. As it turned out, I was totally useless. I'd never been to the US, let alone to Southern California, where Zappa mainly grew up. I didn't know Laurel Canyon from Cucamonga from Orange County. I had no idea what a Howard Johnson's was. I didn't know the difference between a real poncho and a Sears poncho. I had no clue. I couldn't do the cultural translation. But I did like what I heard. All those lyrics about things that rock songs weren't supposed to be about, like plumbers or poodle dogs or communicating with vegetables. And then there were all those snorky noises. There was this one song in particular that my Danish friends and I, we played over and over. It's called The Adventures of Gregory Peccary. It's wildly inventive, lots of zany noises, all of that. But it's also about one of Zappa's favorite targets, what he calls trendmongers.
Well, a trendmonger is a person who dreams up a trend, like the twist, or flower power. And spreads it throughout the land using all the frightening little skills that science has made available.
The more a trend claimed authenticity, the more suspicious Zappa was of it. So, you're a hippie? You're no more than a fashion victim, duped by trendmongers who want to distract you. That message appealed to me, and apparently to many others too, not just in Denmark, but all across Europe. And I think that even if you didn't understand all of the lyrics, or even any of them, I think that the music, the vibe, it was enough to tip you off about what Frank Zappa stood for.
My name is Bodo Mrozek. And I'm a pop music historian, or pop culture historian, a contemporary cultural historian.
I meet Bodo in Potsdam, a city of 18th and 19th century palaces and churches, many of them bombed during World War II and now rebuilt. Right across the street from Bodo's office, a few dozen people are staging a protest in front of another building. It's a student center and cafeteria that was built by the new communist rulers of East Germany right after World War II. You can see why the authorities want to tear it down now. It's an eyesore, made even uglier by all the refined architecture next to it. But it's also the only evidence around that communist East Germany existed. Bodo, on the other hand, is all about East Germany, or the GDR as it was called, the German Democratic Republic. He says in the early days of the GDR, in the 1950s, the authorities were actually quite tolerant of emerging youth culture.
You had East German youth dressing up in a Western way, wearing jeans, wearing what they call Texas shirts, dancing rock and roll. Maybelline,
why can't you be true? This openness didn't last. And when things changed, they changed fast.
There was actually a workers' unrest, which led to heavy riots. The GDR had a problem to explain why the workers turned against the leading party, against the Socialist Party. So the media printed photos of so-called Texas boys and blamed them for causing the unrest. Was a way to blame Western culture and the United States by inventing the Texas Boys. Of course, you had youth who listened to this kind of music, but the creation of the Texas Boy was more or less an image, a fictional image that was created by propagandists in the GDR.
Propagandists, a Cold War term for trendmongers. And they didn't stop there.
They decided to create their own socialist dance.
A dance called the Lipsy, named after the city of Leipzig. The Lipsy was intended to replace rock and roll.
René Dubianski komponierte den Lipsy Nummer 1.
It's an overcomplicated, unsexy trudge. Everything that rock and roll isn't.
Peter Seifert aus der Messestadt Leipzig fand die Tanzschritte für dieses neue Kind der leichten Muse.
Who knows what was discussed in the meetings that came up with the Lipsy? But at some point, this was greenlit. A fake backstory for the dance.
In the lyrics, they introduced little narratives like Mr. Brown from USA visited the GDR and what he found was the Lipsy. So he brought back the Lipsy to Texas.
Wow, they really had a thing with Texas, eh? But what do you know? The Lipsy didn't take off.
East German youth mocked this dance and went through the streets by saying, we don't want the Lipsy and we want Elvis Presley and we want rock and roll.
But they didn't get that. They got the Berlin Wall.
The attention of an anxious world is focused on East and West Germany and Berlin.
1961, the wall went up, with the intention of keeping the West out of the East and the East out of the West. And in many ways, it succeeded. The social upheavals of the 1960s and early 70s were far more muted in East Germany. There was a music scene, but the bands weren't allowed to sing in English, so many of them just didn't sing at all. This is one of those East German bands, the Butlers. Nice, class-conscious English name. East Germans, though, could hear music from the West on the radio, on West Berlin stations. The authorities couldn't jam all of it. And then there were teenagers like Wolfhard Kutz, whose Stasi report described him as a decadent young guy with a tape recorder.
When I was 17, I got from a friend a record of Frank Zappa, and the name of the record was Burnt Weenie Sandwich.
Burnt Weenie Sandwich. Kutz didn't have a clue what that meant. He barely spoke English at the time. You learned Russian at school. But he knew he needed to hear more. So he paid people to buy him Zappa albums in West Germany. He couldn't go there, but he knew people who could. Like Vietnamese guest workers. Yeah, it sounds unlikely. But the Vietnamese came from a brother socialist land, and their visas allowed them to travel across the Iron Curtain. Also, elderly East Germans.
Retired people, they were allowed to go to West Germany. I gave them money with them, and they bought records.
Things didn't always go as planned. One time, Wolfhard placed his order for a Zappa album with an old lady who had a visa to visit her family in the West. But the salesman in the record store thought she got the order wrong.
And the salesman told her, the people in East Germany don't hear Frank Zappa. You mean Frank Zander.
Frank Zander.
Frank Zander.
Frank Zander was a cheesy German comedian and singer.
Ich trinke auf dein Wohl, Marie.
And she brought with her Frank Zander Wahnsinn, is the name of the record. In the past, I didn't find it funny, but today...
He didn't laugh back then because every record bought that way cost him more than a week's salary.
Auf dich ganz allein und in meiner Fantasie wirst du alle Zeit bei mir sein.
Once smuggled into the East, Wolfhart's Zappa Records did the rounds. He helped set up listening circles. That's why his Stasi file notes that he influenced others with his decadent Western ways. These listening circles functioned like libraries, but with their own bespoke distribution systems.
A tape would be dangled out a window on a string. Someone would drive by on a bicycle and snatch it and pass it on to someone else.
This is Jim Cohen, an American and a huge Zappa fan who works as a translator in Germany.
And when the Iron Curtain came down, when the two Germanys were unified, one of the first things that this group of smugglers did is said, we're going to have a party, a concert, finally.
The idea was to make a party and to have fun. To have fun.
There are a lot of pictures up there, probably about 60, 70 people, and they listened to some music, an East German rock band.
And Wolfhart and his friends did something else at that party. It was the night before the West German Deutschmark was to be introduced in East Germany ahead of unification. And so...
we burned our last DDR mark.
Their worthless East German currency up in smoke. Every summer after that, these Zappa fans came together.
And had a good time, and it was stayed very small and familiar for about 10 years, until these fellows realized that what they were doing was in essence a grassroots rock festival, and that they had something that was special because it was not commercial.
The festival is still going. Zappanala, it's called, near the Baltic city of Rostock. A little Zappa in Europe history now. I mentioned that he was big in Europe. In fact, he had more top 40 hits in many European countries than in the US. But in Eastern Europe, that's where they worshipped him. 3 years before Zappa died in 1993, Czech President Václav Havel invited him to Prague. Zappa was amazed at his beyond rock star reception.
Never before in 25 years of rock and roll have I gotten off of an airplane and seen anything like that.
What?
How do you feel?
I feel so tired but so happy to be in Prague.
Zappa and Havel became friends. Havel appointed him special ambassador to the West on trade, culture and tourism. Beyond the Czech Republic, you can find statues of Zappa in Lithuania and Germany, a street named after him in Berlin. He's memorialized. Like Zappa, Jim Cohen grew up in Southern California. He listened to Zappa in a different way from most of us. He actually got the geographical and pop cultural references. He knew the TV shows at the time, the local commercials, the neighborhoods. And then he moved to Germany.
When I was the shared apartment I lived in Freiburg, one of the fellows, one day, just to make conversation, he asked me to explain to him what Bobby Brown, what the lyrics were about, because he had no idea.
Bobby Brown is a Zappa song released in 1979 that was a huge hit in West Germany, which is funny because it's possibly the most offensive song Zappa ever recorded. I'm not going to play it here. It's kind of infantile. If you want to listen to it, it's at all the usual places. The melody, though, is catchy. And you could imagine Germans who didn't understand the lyrics humming along to the tune. Back to Jim and his German flatmate.
When I told him about the bondage and discipline and the various gender mixing going on in the song, he was just aghast. He was like, oh my God, that's terrible. And I thought, hey, this could be good.
Jim realized that Germans had a need he could fulfill.
That's really what made me think of annotating Zappa's lyrics for the Germans, is that even those who speak enough English to, you know, basically to understand what Zappa's writing, they don't know what he's really, really referring to.
And so began Jim Cohen's career as a cultural interpreter. He was the original rap genius long before rap genius existed.
Patrick Cox reporting there. He's back after the break with that moment when some German fans finally figure out what Zappa is singing about. Maybe.
Call any vegetable, call any carabine.
Back now to our feature story from our language podcast, The World in Words, about Frank Zappa's legacy among his fans in the former East Germany. Just before the break, Patrick Cox had introduced us to Jim Cohen. Cohen grew up in California, but by the late 1970s, he was living in West Germany, working as a technical translator by day, translating Zappa lyrics for friends by night. Here again is Patrick Cox.
It wasn't long until Jim Cohen's Zappa translating skills turned him into a semi-pro Zappa expert. He got an evening gig at a seedy Munich bar. There he delivered boozy lectures about Frank Zappa's songs. And over time, he realized that Zappa had long been perceived very differently in Germany. People thought of him as a protest-like performer, like Bob Dylan.
They expect Zappa to primarily be sort of this politician, poet, satirist. And Zappa was indeed that to some extent, but he was also simply having a lot of fun.
Zappa himself confounded expectations. At a concert in West Berlin in 1968, he rejected the demands of some in the crowd to set fire to the Allied command center nearby. The crowd wanted revolution, and they rioted. Zappa denounced them as naive and stupid. He didn't buy radical politics any more than he bought the hippie lifestyle.
Zappa was certainly not a hippie. He was no fan of the whole movement, that whole creation. He saw it as simple media creation. It was another fad.
Where you going with that button on your shirt?
What did he say one time? The revolution is this year's flower power.
Where you going with that button on your shirt? I'm going to the love end to sit and play my bongos in the dirt.
In the late 90s, Jim Cohen approached Wolfhard Kutz, whose annual Zappa party had by then morphed into the small festival Zappanala. Kutz and his co-promoters said, yeah, come do your thing.
And it rained so that they basically shortened the festival and cut out my presentation. But I was lucky enough to see that they could maybe use some stage continuity. And so I managed to sort of weasel my way in as the stage MC.
Mit Kommunisten zu tun und sie übt auch...
At this year's Zappanala, Jim's a star. He's interpreting a song called Billy the Mountain, recorded by Zappa and the Mothers of Invention 46 years ago. There are perhaps a couple hundred people, mainly late middle-aged, packed inside a tent, listening to Jim as he prowls the stage in a 1950s plaid jacket, beer in hand. That's his lecture style. The song Billy the Mountain is a surreal story of a mountain called Billy, who, you know, talks, and his sidekick, Ethel, who's a tree.
Billy was a mountain!
Billy was a mountain.
Ethel was a tree growing off of his shoulder.
Ethel was a tree growing off of his shoulder.
Jim tells his audience that Billy the Mountain is Zappa's take on the classic monster movie. Billy plays the role of the innocent monster, who nonetheless in this story destroys Edwards Air Force Base.
Edwards Air Force Base.
A place where Zappa's father once worked, but also poses for postcard photos and gets rich from the royalties. Much else happens, but Jim's talk is dominated by the cultural details. He has to explain what a grand jury is. Also references to a Jerry Lewis telethon, a Jack-in-the-Box restaurant, frozen beef pieces at a Boney's market, a Dudley Do-Right wristwatch, and a local car dealership that leases Cadillacs. I could go on. It's mind-boggling. And it takes more than 90 minutes. The audience loves it. Jim has them in the palm of his hand.
Oh, that's two minutes so good.
The musical acts at Zappanala are all off the beaten path, you might say, including several Zappa cover bands, a polka group from Austria, and a Japanese jazz rock ensemble. But the main act this year is Frank's son, Dweezil Zappa, his first appearance here.
Herzlich willkommen, Mr. Dweezil Zappa.
Jim introduces all of the performers. And he also does a Q&A with Dweezil inside an overpacked tent, heaving with the unwashed bodies, for many days unwashed bodies, of aging German Zappa fans.
Dweezil, there are rumors going around that you want to play for 3 hours. Is that right?
If any place could tolerate 3 hours, it would be here at Zappanala.
For the East German old-timers here at the festival, the meaning of Zappa has evolved from those years under communism. Then they listened furtively, and they didn't fully comprehend what they were listening to. Nowadays, there's the internet, there's Google Translate, and there's Jim to explain what the lyrics are about. In between those times, there was that moment, something that many fans here talk about, that moment when you finally figured out,
wow,
what Zappa was actually singing about.
It's our black and dirty humor.
Black and dirty humor.
It's about sex. Very krass. We say krass in German. Very hard words. But why not? Everybody does sex.
This wasn't the only woman at the festival who expressed a kind of awkward surprise at learning the meaning of some of Zappa's more salacious lyrics. Towards the end of Zappanala, I broach a sensitive subject with Wolfhard Kutz, the festival's founder. 10 years ago, the festival was sued by the Zappa Family Trust for copyright infringement. The trust didn't want them to use Zappa's name or likeness. A German court ultimately sided with Zappanala and against the family. It was a strange moment for Kutz, with his history of growing up a Zappa fan in an unfree society. Especially, as he says, because it was from his idol that he learned how to stay just the right side of the law.
I liked how Zappa shows his protest in a manner with that he don't go or don't have or can't put in a prison.
Staying out of prison, it's more effective. It certainly helped Wolfhard survive totalitarianism. Better to be under the radar, an outsider. I tell Wolfhard I think he's still an outsider. He still loves a musician who snubbed his nose at the trendmongers. And he's running an event that doesn't meet the approval of the official keepers of Frank Zappa's legacy. How does that feel, I ask him?
I feel good with that. I love to be an outsider. It's wonderful.
We are the other people, we are the other people, we are the other people, you're the other people too.
The remarkable story of Frank Zappa and his East German fans came to us from The World in Words, Patrick Cox. You can subscribe to The World in Words podcast at Apple Podcasts or wherever you choose to get your podcasts. The World's theme music was composed by Eric Goldberg. But we'll leave you with some Frank Zappa today. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. Have a great weekend.
Let me take a minute and tell you my plan. Let me take a minute and tell who I am. If it doesn't show, think you better know I'm another person. Do you think that my pants are too tight? Do you think that I'm creepy? Let me take a minute and tell you my plan. Let me take a minute and tell who I am. If it doesn't show, think you better know I'm another person.
PRI, Public Radio International.